Texas Fish and Game Magazine, May-June 2025, issue, audio edition. In this issue, stream stress. Fishing Texas rivers and streams is a real challenge in a state with 97% private land ownership. Texas Fish and Game Special Report, Offshore Star Strategies. Summer in the Gulf is prime time for CCA Star Tournament anglers. Feature story by Fish and Game staff. Charmed by Snakes, Doggett's Texas Snake Adventures, feature article by Joe Doggett. Keeping it fresh. Matt Williams, Fish and Game's Freshwater Authority. A profile, feature story by Chester Moore. Back to basics for reds, targeting seagrass flats for redfish. Feature story by Fish and Game staff. Group On, a dream outing for Goliath grouper. Feature article by Paul Fusinski. Give the Outdoors, alternative ideas for Mother's and Father's Day giving. Fish and Game special section. Plus, columns, outdoor news in the Fish and Game Report. Coastal focus reports by professional saltwater guides as special hunting center report. And more. So listen, learn, and enjoy. Is Doge inspiring threats to the Texas outdoors? Inside Fish and Game by Roy and Ardia Neves. A member of the Texas State Legislature recently took out his frustrations with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department by introducing a bill to abolish the department. Perhaps inspired by the rapid-fire budget slashing and wholesale agency shutdowns that the new Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, has been conducting in Washington, a bill was filed on March 13th seeking to shut Parks and Wildlife down and divvy up its assets and responsibilities to three other separate departments. According to the Houston Chronicle, the legislation may have been motivated by a long-standing beef this representative has had with the department over its treatment of the state's deer breeders, and in particular, its response to chronic wasting disease. Fortunately, for those of us who live and work in what is, without argument, the richest outdoors environment in the country, the bill has apparently been tabled. Pushback was swift and intense, and it came from every corner of the outdoors enthusiast community. Hunters, anglers, boaters, conservationists, nature lovers, environmentalists. Although this legislative attack on Texas outdoor sports may have been averted, we now have to add another potential threat to the growing list of hazards endangering the outdoors way of life. Anti-hunting activists, animal rights organizations, loss of habitat to the forces of nature and to human progress, and now the potential threat of irreparable damage from our own state leaders. House Bill 4938 probably never would have made it to the governor's desk, but it's scary to think of the chaos it would have unleashed if it had. And now that this first punch has been thrown, what's to stop another attack from a different direction? The commercial fishing lobby, or some band of well-heeled barstool biologists who think they know more about viral transmission statistics than researchers with decades of experience, and who might have the ear or pockets of a sympathetic legislator. Texas Parks and Wildlife, like any governing body, federal, state, county, municipal, neighborhood HOA, certainly has its flaws, and we've been critical of many of their actions. But we're also absolutely certain that without their stewardship of the state's outdoor resources, Texans would not have anywhere near the wealth of fresh and saltwater fishing opportunities, nor the abundance of game species for hunting, in a state with less than 5% publicly managed land that TPWD has given us. Just consider the scope of what Parks and Wildlife manages. 88 parks, natural areas, and historical sites. Licensing and regulation of all fresh and saltwater fishing and hunting. All recreational boat licensing and registration, boating safety and education. 50 wildlife management areas covering a 250,000 acres in every ecological region of the state. Conservation of the vast diversity of habitat across the Texas range, from coastal marshes to high plains desert. Fisheries management that has built and maintained thriving populations of fresh and saltwater species, from Florida strain largemouth and striped bass to red drum and spotted sea trout. Law enforcement embodied in a force of game wardens empowered with jurisdictional authority on par with Texas Rangers, who not only enforce game laws and stop poaching, but are sworn to enforce all state laws. many more functions and management responsibilities fall under the department's command. Above is only a top-of-mind description of a fully mature organization that has been fulfilling a broad set of missions for 3/4 of a century, since its conversion from the Texas Game, Fish and Oyster Commission into its modern incarnation and rechristening as the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Understand this, if TPWD goes down, fishing and hunting in Texas will suffer. No matter how its functions are peeled off and redistributed to other departments, it could have made sense to break such a large portfolio of critical missions into 2 or 3 different departments. But to completely shut down an agency with a pretty damn solid track record and saddle other existing departments that already have their own challenges in a rapidly growing state with huge new responsibilities is a recipe for epic disaster. Whether House Bill 4938 was just DOGE-inspired political theater or simply an expression of personal frustration from a disgruntled legislator, we need to take it seriously. Because next time it might be a real threat to break the agency we count on to protect our outdoors resources. There is a thirst for government blood these days. God knows, every organization, whether it's a bloated federal or state agency, or even a small two-man partnership, can always stand a healthy round of cost-cutting. But to take a chainsaw to a department as vital to Texas anglers and hunters as TPWD is not healthy. It's just plain stupid. Email Ardia at aneves@fishgame.com. Email Roy at rneves@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. The Jaws Effect. Editor's Notes by Chester Moore. Texas Fish and Game Editor-in-Chief. The water was cold, stained, and rough. Stormy seas had stirred up the sediments, creating brown-tinged visibility that only allowed me to see out 15 feet at best. And with subsurface temperatures in the lower 50s, the environment inside the shark cage I was in alone seemed surreal. It was like some bizarre dream, but then reality came crashing in. A small school of fish and a few squid had gathered in front of the cage, and they all left in a flash. Something spooked them. And suddenly, it was like someone piped in the Jaws theme as I saw a massive dark shape maneuvering below the cage. It would move in and out, and then around and disappear. At one point, it kicked up the silt into the bottom of the cage, and I feared being enveloped in darkness, and maybe just a tad bit of what was swimming just below the line of visibility. That was the beginning of an incredible experience, cage diving for great white sharks in the Pacific Ocean in the Farallon Islands. It was a dream born from seeing Jaws for the first time as a little kid watching an ABC movie of the week. I was too young to have seen it in theaters, but the film had no less an impact on me on the small screen. I was blown away at the idea of great white sharks and thought the characters Mr. Hooper and Captain Quint were incredible. I vowed to one day see great white sharks, and that fateful viewing, along with seeing Jacques Cousteau ocean specials, inspired me to seek out such an opportunity. And it had a whole lot to do with my interest in the ocean and marine conservation. This year is the 50th anniversary of Jaws, and while there's no doubt the landmark film stirred up plenty of fear about sharks and might have even spawned some persecution of great whites, it has inspired many people to get into shark conservation. Top great white researcher Dr. Greg Skomal told me last year he decided to study sharks when seeing Richard Dreyfuss's portrayal of Hooper. When I was 12 years old, my dad took my friend Chris and I fishing on the 61st Street Pier in Galveston. That night, some of the anglers were catching small bonitheads. I was blown away. This was my first time seeing sharks in person, and it all became very real to me that night. I remember standing with my dad staring at a full moon glimmering over the surf. I asked whether there were any great whites in the Gulf and even in Texas waters. "Maybe so," Dad said. Then in 2005, my friend Captain Ryan Warhola saw a great white while fishing at an oil rig about 55 miles out of Sabine Pass, and I began a full-on investigation of their presence in the Gulf. It was exciting to see sharks tagged by Oshirch pop up on the Gulf side of Florida a decade later, and in 2021, Texas Fish and Game broke the story of their tagged great white that showed up about 125 miles off of Galveston. As exciting as that was, it was still distant to the public. But on February 26, 2024, a great white shark closed the distance in a big way, showing up 100 yards from the beach at South Padre Island. Lee Beth, a 14-foot, 2,600-pound great white shark, breached the surface and allowed the tag affixed to her dorsal fin to connect with a satellite. That fed her coordinates into the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy's AWSC app Sharktivity and made history. For 20 years, I have been investigating accounts of great whites in the Gulf, and this story shifted the dynamic of the topic in amazing ways. Lee Beth was fitted with a satellite tag by Captain Chip Mikolov of Outcast Sport Fishing and AWSC's Megan Winton off the coast of South Carolina. After leaving South Padre, she went all the way up the Texas coast, passing a few miles from the rig where Warhola had his encounter. Then she went all the way up to Nova Scotia. Lee Beth has by far been the most ping-happy shark of those tracked by our program, said Megan Winton, AWSC research scientist. Every shark is different, and some spend more time at the surface than others. The track from her fin-mounted real-time satellite tag is helping us better understand the species' migration in the Gulf and fill in the gaps associated with the other tag types we use to track the species' movements. My interest in all of this, dating back to Jaws, has an exciting tie-in for the film's 50th anniversary. I am producing a documentary called Gulf Great White Sharks, Return of an Icon, and I am doing it with cinematographer Paul Fusinski, who you know from doing our Aptitude Outdoors column. We will be debuting it at a public viewing and a special shark seminar at the Museum of the Gulf Coast in Port Arthur, 2 p.m., Saturday, June 21st. That will be 50 years exactly to the weekend Jaws debuted in cinemas around the country and changed moviegoing forever. It also changed me forever, as great white sharks have taken a bite out of my heart that have made me want to promote their education and stand for their conservation. When I jumped into that shark cage 20 years ago, it wasn't being brave. Heck, I was scared, excited, and blown away all at once. It was knowing if I didn't do it that I would let a lifelong dream pass me by. And in a world that seems increasingly chaotic, we need to chase more of those dreams, even if those dreams sport razor-sharp teeth. Go to www.gulfgreatwhites.com for details about the film and viewing. Email Chester Moore at cmoore@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Redfish to the Bone. Doggett at Large, by Joe Doggett, Texas Fish and Game Senior Contributing Editor. My Bahamian guide, Charles, whose last name I can't remember, had a calm demeanor and osprey eyes. Both are excellent attributes on a bonefish flat. A single at 10 o'clock, moving left to right at 40 feet, he said, planting the push pole and stopping the skiff. Nice fish. I was on the bow casting platform and suffering from an abrupt case of jitters. Nice fish is not to be confused with banana bone or pocket bone, especially when Charles is rendering the verdict. I stared wildly at the sun sparkle of shallow sand and saw nothing moving. Bonefish are almost always moving. Point your rod. No, more left. There. See him? Yeah, got him. The unsuspecting bonefish weighed at least 6 pounds, maybe 7. It was a fish capable of ripping an entire 8-weight fly line and 100 yards of backing line across the flat. The prize that sun-blasted saltwater anglers invest big money and time and travel to encounter. I released the fly from the pinched fingers of my left hand and rolled the belly of fly line off the rod tip and into the air. A quick glance underfoot confirmed that the stripped coils on the deck were clear. Two quick double hauls gained distance, and I drilled a tight loop about 6 feet ahead of the slowly moving fish. Looking good, I thought. I failed to allow for the gusting side-angle wind, a rookie mistake. A billow caught the outgoing line, and the number 4 bead chain mantis shrimp hit the fish right between the eyes. The violated cruiser reacted as only a startled bonefish can, blasting away like a strobe of streaming light. All that remained of the plumbered opportunity were puffs and clouds of marl. My shrill epithets followed the blistering wake across the flat. The diplomatic Charles leaned on the push pole and shrugged. Mon, you hit a little close on that one. That incident last December was a reinforcement that it's difficult to outgrow the ability to screw up when sight casting on the flats. Maybe this is why it is so addictive. Bonefish launched the craze almost 75 years ago, Florida Keys and Bahamas, but our own redfish offer a similar high-stakes game. Reds lack the Corvette gearbox of bonefish, but they are plenty game, especially in mere inches of tide, and the shallow clearwater bays and back lakes of the lower and middle Texas coast are prime for sight casting. And of course, the fabulous Delta complex of Louisiana offers excellent potential. Reds tail like bonefish, inverting to root on bottom, and they cruise the shallows like bonefish, either as singles or in small pods. As a bonus, bold redfish in shallow water are easier for average eyes to spot, and they tend to be less spooky and more grabby. An aggressive red will snatch a variety of shrimp and crab patterns, as well as baitfish streamers and surface poppers. Bonefish or redfish, the flats and shorelines are the ideal venue for the specialized drill of sight casting with a fly rod from a skiff. The disciplines are the same, and the ability to choke in the clutch remains constant. Following decades of juggling the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat, I feel qualified to offer a few pointers for improving the odds on the former. First, don't forget the polarized sunglasses. No, not your go-to pair. I'm talking about the backup pair that should be in your boat bag. Vision is critical in this game, so don't gamble a big trip on a single pair. Aborting a sure cast to a big fish by stepping on the outgoing fly line is one of the most infuriating blunders in all of fly fishing. Whenever possible, I fish barefoot, trusting to sensitive toes to feel for sifting coils on the deck. Clumping around in wading boots or beach sandals with Velcro straps is begging for a snag double haul and a cackle of glee from your fishing partner. Regarding stripped line, pile no more on the deck than necessary for a realistic cast. This minimizes potential windblown tangles, and when a hooked fish accelerates, a short surplus is quicker and easier to feed through the rod guides. A butt wrap or a handle wrap can be devastating. Remember the clock coordinates, with the bow being 12 o'clock. This sounds simple, but it's easy for a flustered caster to get confused. If you want to feel like a proper chump, listen to an impatient guide shout, "No, no, your other 2 o'clock." Trust me, this is embarrassing. Keep in mind that the guide almost certainly is better at spotting fish by sifting through the moving tableau of sand and grass and rubble and chops on a shallow flat. This especially is true when the lights go out behind a cloud. If nothing else, the stern poling platform offers a higher vantage for looking down through the water ahead. Leave the long game to the professional and concentrate on scanning close, inside 30 feet, and be prepared for a quick draw on a fish that appears from nowhere. It happens often. A sidearm presentation from a predatory crouch should close the deal. Once you're cocked and locked on the bowl, with the fly in one hand and the rod in the other, enough weight forward belly should be off the rod tip for a quick load, but not too much line. A long belly dragging alongside might snag floating grass, or worse, slide under the bow and hang on the hull. Naturally, that's when a big fish waddles past. Strive to minimize false casts. Frantically fanning the air 8 or 10 times wastes time and might spook a skittish fish. Oh yes, learn to double haul. Your flats game will remain forever lame without this supercharger that increases line speed for extra shooting distance. Once that tight loop delivers the fly, take up any slack and keep the rod tip low to the water, and do not trout strike by lifting the rod tip high. Always strip strike with a straight pull with the line hand. And, bonefish or redfish, be prepared to experience the soaring highs and crushing lows that await on every flat. Email Joe Doggett at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Stream stress. Fishing Texas's rivers and streams is a real challenge in a state with 97% private land ownership. Feature article by Chester Moore. One of the biggest challenges inland anglers face in Texas, especially in the western two-thirds of the state where large navigable rivers are scarce, is access. Texas is 97% private land, and that means most of the land around streams and rivers is private. Texas Parks and Wildlife has a Q&A on these issues we thought would give an important look at an issue we will be diving more into in our 3x weekly e-newsletter. This is directly from TPWD and is a great place to begin looking at the issue. What is considered a public stream? In Texas, a stream is public if it is, quote, navigable in fact, or navigable by statute, unquote. There is no precise test for whether a stream is navigable in fact. The term is based on the idea of public utility. One court has observed that waters, which in their natural state are useful to the public for a considerable portion of the year, are navigable. A stream is navigable by statute if it retains an average width of 30 feet from the mouth up. It is important to understand that the entire stream bed is to be included in the width, not just the area covered by water on a given day. A navigable stream may be dry part of the year, but does not lose its character as a navigable stream. To complicate matters, some Texas land titles originated with Spanish or Mexican land grants, and the law of Spain and Mexico did not distinguish public and private streams on the basis of navigability. Streams were valued primarily as a source of water for household use and for irrigation, rather than a way to move people and goods. So when the sovereign granted land, perennial streams were retained for public use, regardless of navigability, so as to make as much land as possible capable of settlement. A stream is perennial if it flows most or all of the year. In determining the rights of holders of title under Mexican grants, the laws of Mexico were in effect when the grants were made control. So in counties that contain Spanish or Mexican land grants, there are an unknown number of perennial streams which are public streams, even though they may not be navigable. Question: how do I determine the boundary of a stream bed? The Texas Supreme Court has stated that the bed of a stream is that portion of its soil which is alternately covered and left bare, as there may be an increase or diminution in the supply of water, and which is adequate to contain it at its average and mean stage during an entire year, without reference to the extra freshets of the winter or spring, or the extreme droughts of the summer or autumn. Not clear? Again, the Texas Supreme Court. The stream bed is that land between the gradient boundary on each bank. The gradient boundary is defined as a gradient of the flowing water in the stream and is located midway between the lower level of the flowing water that just reaches the cut bank and the higher level of it that just does not overtop the cut bank. Clear as mud. Blame it on those civil judges. Question: what if the stream is dry? A navigable stream does not lose its public character during periods of low water. A stream is navigable if the bed of the stream averages 30 feet wide from the mouth up, regardless of the actual water level on a given day. Question: what is a public lake? The typical public lake in Texas was created by building a dam on a navigable stream. When a navigable stream is dammed, the resulting lake is a public lake, and the public may boat and fish on all of the lake's waters, not just that part directly above the stream bed. Therefore, a property owner may not fence off any portion of such a lake. For other lakes, the test is whether the lake is navigable. Typically, the small natural lakes in Texas are held to be non-navigable and therefore subject to private ownership and control. Man-made stock tanks and flood control ponds are usually non-navigable as well. The public has no right to boat, fish, or hunt in or on the waters of private lakes, and hunting or fishing without landowner consent is a crime. In order to encourage outdoor recreation, the legislature has limited the liability of landowners who allow the public to use their property for recreational purposes. Question: but doesn't the state own the waters of all lakes and flowing streams, plus the fish that live there? Yes, the state does own the water of every lake and natural stream, and the fish that live there, but that does not give the public the right to fish or boat in private lakes or streams. Question: some landowners in my county have deeds to the riverbed. Can they exclude the public from their part of the river? Not if the river is navigable. The policy of the government of Texas, expressed in statute since the days of the Republic, has been to retain the beds of navigable streams as public property. However, the state surveyors did not always adhere to this law, and some land grants purported to include the beds of navigable streams. To remedy this situation, in a 1929 law known as the Small Bill, the state relinquished to the adjoining landowners certain property rights in the beds of some navigable streams. However, this statute declared that it did not impair the rights of the general public and the state in the waters of the streams. So even if a landowner's deed includes the bed of a navigable stream, and taxes are being paid on the bed, the public retains its right to use it as a navigable stream. It is a fairly common myth that a person boating along a small bill stream may not set foot on the stream bed if the landowner forbids it. This is based on the notion that a person who steps into the stream bed has entered onto private property within the meaning of the criminal trespass law. This may have some applicability when the waters of a stream leave its banks and a boater navigates out of the stream bed and steps onto the adjacent private lands, or on coastal land when tide waters cover private property. But the general public has the right to walk within the boundaries of any navigable stream bed, even if there are private ownership rights under the small bill. Question: what is it legal to do in a public lake stream? Texas courts have recognized that a member of the public may engage in a variety of activities in, on, and along a public lake or stream. Besides boating, persons may swim, float, walk, wade, picnic, camp, and, with a license, fish. These activities must be confined to the waters of the lake or stream and the stream bed. The public does not have the right to cross private property to get to or from public water. In fact, that can constitute criminal trespass if the other elements of the offense are present. With some exceptions, driving a motor vehicle in the bed of a navigable stream is prohibited, other than the Canadian River and the Prairie Dog Town Fork of Red River. Do you have concerns about stream access? What are they? Shoot us an email at cmore@fishgame.com and we will do our best to address them in forthcoming articles to raise awareness of stream access do's and don'ts in Texas. Thanks for listening. Offshore star strategies. Summer in the Gulf is prime time for anglers fishing the CCA Star Tournament. Feature article by Texas Fish and Game staff. The thrill of hooking into a sleek and powerful kingfish, battling a stubborn ling, landing a monster red snapper, or chasing Dorado along weed lines makes for an unforgettable experience and can lead to big star wins. King mackerel. King mackerel thrive in the warm waters of the Gulf during summer, making them a prime target for star anglers. They are commonly found near reefs, wrecks, oil rigs, and along current edges where bait fish gather. Best gear and setup. Use a medium heavy to heavy spinning or conventional rod and reel with a 20 to 40 pound test monofilament or braided line. A wire leader is essential to prevent their sharp teeth from cutting the line. Bait selection. Live bait such as mullet, menhaden, and cigar minnows are the best choices. A stinger rig increases hookup rates, as kings tend to strike from behind. Trolling tactics. Troll live bait or brightly colored lures behind the boat at 6 to 8 knots. Vary depths until you locate the feeding fish. Some of the biggest kingfish of the summer are landed in June, so now is the time to gear up and hit the offshore waters. Ling, cobia. A big bonus for anglers fishing around rigs is the cobia, also known as ling. These fish love structure and frequently hang around oil platforms, standpipes, jetties, and buoys. Unconventional technique. Rev up your boat motors, take a paddle, and slap the water's surface. While it may seem counterintuitive, this noise can bring cobia up from the depths. Baiting for ling. Toss a handful of cut pogies overboard and use live crab or fresh cut bait on circle hooks. Tracking cobia. Recent research suggests that many cobia return to the same spots year after year. If you missed out on a big one last summer, it might still be there this season, and even hungrier. In Star, a solid cobia catch can earn you serious prizes, making it well worth the effort to target these structure-dwelling fish. Red snapper. While catching red snapper in the Gulf isn't difficult, finding and landing big ones is another story. To increase your chances of winning the Star Snapper division, follow these key tips. Find lightly pressured structures. While rigs are common snapper hotspots, they are heavily fished. Seek out wrecks or outer structures away from major rig fields. Use the right bait. Live bait like pinfish and croaker is often overlooked but highly effective. If unavailable, jigs tipped with fresh-cut bait are a good alternative. Fish the right depth. Snapper are typically found at 50 to 200 feet. Don't just drop bait to the bottom. Use electronics to locate the fish at specific depths and adjust your technique accordingly. Red snapper are not only great fighters and excellent table fare, but they also present a valuable opportunity for star participants to win big. Dorado, mahi-mahi. Dorado, commonly found along Texas coast weed lines, are aggressive feeders and an exciting target for offshore anglers. Locating weed lines, sargassum accumulates in Gulf currents, creating floating habitats for baitfish and attracting large predators like dorado. Look for dark patches or lines on the water's surface, using polarized sunglasses for better visibility. Gear up right. A 7 to 8 foot medium-heavy rod paired with a high-speed reel works best. Use a 30-50-pound braided mainline with a 4 to 6 feet fluorocarbon leader, 40 to 60-pound test. Live bait options include ballyhoo, blue runners, and mullet. Trolling strategies. Troll at 5 to 7 knots along weed lines, deploying 2 to 3 lines at different distances. If you spot dorado near the surface, cast live bait toward them and allow it to drift naturally. Dorado are fast and aggressive, making them a rewarding catch both for sport and in the star competition. Fishing the CCA Star Offshore Division requires skill, strategy, and an understanding of how each target species behaves. Whether chasing king mackerel around wrecks, luring cobia from rigs, searching for big red snapper in lesser fished waters, or trolling for dorado along weed lines, preparation is key. June presents the best opportunity for some of the largest catches of the season, and with these expert tips, you can maximize your chances of landing a prize-winning fish. Tight lines, and best of luck in Star. Thanks for listening. A Life with the Snakes. Doggett's Texas Snake Adventures. Feature article by Joe Doggett. A water snake was better than a ribbon snake, and a hog-nosed snake was better than a water snake, and a rat snake was twice as good as the whole passel in a sack. That was our standard of measure during junior high snake collecting days along the banks of Houston's Brays Bayou. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, that uncut and natural drainage was an amazing strip of wildness snaking through the southern tier of the growing urban sprawl. Our bounty represented a microcosm. Texas boasts at least 72 snake species, by far the most of any state. If various subspecies and intergrades are included, the count is more than 100. The Lone Star State's size is not the whole story. It has 10 ecological regions, or 6 biotic provinces. Regardless of how the vastness is environmentally sliced and diced, it provides an unmatched variety of habitat, and generally temperate conditions encourage prosperity among cold-blooded reptiles. I can document 10 species and subspecies in the 2 to 3 mile stretch of urban bayou within reach of our long-ago forays with angle-iron snake sticks, muslin collecting bags, and knee-high rubber boots. Several were scarce and others common, but all were native. The confirmed Brays Bayou denizens, Texas rat snake, eastern yellow-bellied racer, rough earth snake, Texas ground snake, decay snake, western ribbon snake, eastern garter snake, rough keeled green snake, yellow-bellied water snake, diamond-backed water snake, eastern hog-nosed snake, speckled king snake, southern copperhead, and Texas coral snake. For several friends, snake collecting was a passing fancy, a way to tap into the wildness of the bayou, along with trapping the odd possum or fishing for short-nosed gar or plinking with BB rifles. But I was serious about the study of reptiles, herpetology. I had a growing collection of books. Classics were North American Snakes, 1939, and Thrills of a Naturalist's Quest, 1947, Raymond Dittmar's Adventures with Reptiles, The Story of Ross Allen, 1951, C.J. Highlander, Snakes and Snake Hunting, 1957, Carl Kaufeld, and A Field Guide to Reptiles and Amphibians, 1958, Roger Conant. Those authors were among my childhood idols, and they were not sideshow hucksters. Dittmar's was curator of the prestigious Bronx Zoo. Allen was founder of the Reptile Institute in Silver Springs, Florida. Kaufeld was director of the Staten Island Zoo, and Conant was curator of reptiles at the Philadelphia Zoo. Our real-life herpetological hero was John Werler, curator of reptiles at the nearby Houston Zoo in Herman Park. He was tolerant of star-struck kids and went on to become curator of the entire zoo, but he remained a snake man. He co-authored with James Dixon in 2000 the monumental 437-page text, Texas snakes, identification, distribution, and natural history. Back in the Braes Bayou days, I would have been stunned, utterly blown away by such a comprehensive book defining local snakes. I was an only child of loving parents, neither of whom had any particular interest in the outdoors. Being often alone, I found solace and satisfaction in wandering the banks of the old bayou, a fledgling naturalist's quest. My collecting perimeter expanded, adding green water snakes, broad-banded water snakes, and salt marsh snakes from Sheldon Reservoir to the southeast, and western pygmy rattlesnakes and western cottonmouths from the memorial area on the west side. Oddly, while cottonmouths were semi-common around certain Houston area drainages, we never found one along our stretch of Braes Bayou. The big prize, literally, was the Lindheimer's rat snake. Most of our catches were less than length, but a mature rat snake might measure 5 to 6 feet, a double handful of serious snake. One spring morning, on the south bank of Braes Bayou near Scott Street Bridge, I caught one that taped 6 feet 9 inches. The fact that such a creature thrived between North and South McGregor Streets only confirmed the rightness of the old bayou. Elapha obsoleta lindheimeri was named after Ferdinand Jacob Lindheimer, a 19th century naturalist acknowledged as the father of Texas botany. Shortly after the Alamo fell, he presumably was poking around the hill country looking for a morning glory, Ipomoea lindheimeri, and bumbled onto and cataloged the writhing coils of a fine rat snake specimen. Why subsequent experts saw fit to dismiss Lindheimer and change the name to Texas rat snake, or worse, Western rat snake, is a mystery. To old-timer snake collectors, the undeniable pedigree still stands. Wow, a big Lindheimer's! And I grudgingly concede only because Werler used Texas rat snake. My first exposure to native snakes outside the Gulf Prairies and Piney Woods ecoregions occurred during the early 60s. My father was an English professor at the University of Houston, and two of his colleagues, Wilson Hudson and Francis Abernethy, were long-standing members of the Texas Folklore Society. They encouraged our family to join them at the annual April meeting. That year, the site was in West Texas, Midland, with a side trip to Monahans Sandhills State Park. The arid terrain below the visitor's center at the massive Monahans Dunes was spiked with thornbrush and sagebrush, a panorama right out of Walt Disney's The Living Desert movie, and spring is prime snake season. Dear old dad, rather than listening to the readings and lectures from folklore luminaries such as J. Frank Dobie and Modi Boatwright, I bailed to the beckon of the desert. I had no collecting equipment other than a semi-straight stick, but was thrilled to wander and look. The morning was clear and mild, favorable for snake movement, and I caught and released a new species, a bull snake. The impressive snake was about 4 feet in length. Like the rat snake, it was a constrictor, but with thicker girth and an irritable attitude. A crescent of bleeding tooth marks across the right wrist attested to the fact that outdrawing a jacked-up snake is difficult. However, a non-venomous bite comes under the heading of no big drama. The superficial scratches from the tiny teeth are like raking a vine of briar thorns. During those early years, I was bitten dozens of times. Ribbon snakes, water snakes, rat snakes, and never had a complication. 30 minutes later, I stirred up a major first, a western diamond-backed rattlesnake. It was coiled near a thick mott of brush and prickly pear. The alarmed rattler was mature, about the length of the bull snake, but heavier and buzzing with an undeniable aura. William Blake's Tiger, Tiger Burning Bright is not the only creature with fearful symmetry. The diamondback bowed up in an awesome display as I feinted with the stick. The bulbous head and sifting coils and furious tail radiated danger. I was stunned. Whoa, Ross Allen and Carl Kaufeld and John Werler might hand grab that thing, but no way I'm getting near it. My few piddly copperheads and an aptly named 16-inch pygmy rattlesnake were not remotely in the same league. Kaufeld proudly wrote in Snakes and Snake Hunting, "If we be permitted to verge on the sensational, our own diamondback rattlesnakes are among the world's first four largest and most deadly snakes. The king cobra, the bushmaster, and the fer de lance are its only rivals." He was mainly referring to Crotalus adamantius, the eastern diamondback of the southeastern coastal states. This formidable pit viper has been documented at more than 8 feet in length, with a few sketchy reports of 9-footers. The Western Diamondback comes in about a foot shorter on an honest tape. Snake stories like fish stories tend to grow, and snake skins or mounts can be stretched. But a live 5 or 6 footer of either issue is a huge thick snake with large venom sacs and long fangs. RC, Aatrox might be a tad shy against its eastern counterpart, but it is far more plentiful over a greater range. And it is more aggressive when cornered. Not that any logical individual could blame a snake on its own turf for firing back when harassed. For better or worse, Texas has another first, the motherlode of these world-class pit vipers. The diamondback rattler is common across the hill country in South Texas, and downright plentiful along the saltgrass regions of the middle and lower coast. Texas tallies between 1,000 and 1,500 venomous snake bites per year, and most are from diamondbacks and urban copperheads. The upside is that only 1 or 2 per year are fatal. Copperheads are small snakes with weak venom, and the diamondbacks usually are within an hour or two of emergency rooms and anti-venin injections. A bad bite, of course, is a miserable and potentially life-threatening ordeal. On the Christmas following the Folklore Society trip, I received my most memorable gift. It was an impressive pyramid-type cabinet of dark varnished hardwood on a bench of short legs, 3 rectangular snake cages, 2 on the lower level and a larger one on top. Individual glass panes slid back and forth on aluminum runners, and each cage interior was painted flat white and sported a socket for a small light bulb activated by an exterior toggle switch. Whirler himself would have nodded approval, and I was overwhelmed. The piece of furniture meant my mother had consented to allow several harmless snakes inside the house. The major move from rough cages of orange crates and hardware cloth on the back porch was an acknowledgement that I was focused, that herpetology represented a legitimate path forward. The best part, my thoughtful father did not drive to the nearest Snakes R Us store and purchase the elaborate cage. He and a handy neighbor, Fred Y., designed and constructed it in Fred's garage. "Oh, it's nothing, son. I'm just helping Fred make a cabinet for his record album collection." A parade of the usual Braze Bayou suspects passed through the sliding glass portals, and several non-resident standouts were a 4-foot corn snake, a 5-foot Florida king snake, and a gorgeous 6-foot eastern indigo snake. The naturalist's quest was expanding, and herpetology was thriving. It didn't last. Thanks for listening. Fawns and Velvet, Texas Whitetails, by Larry Y. Soon, Texas Fish and Game, Whitetail Hunting Editor. Fawns are hitting the ground, and we're starting to see them up and around with the does. From what I've seen so far, looks like we're going to have a pretty good fawn crop this year, and we should have pretty good herd recruitment as a result. "Looks like the predator control we did late winter is paying off," said David Cotton, whose property is not far from the Trinity River, east of Dallas. Before I could comment, David added, "Not only that, but bucks are starting to get interesting again, seeing what looks like the makings of a good antler year." I was thrilled to hear what he had been seeing on all accounts. This mostly because of the habitat and herd management programs we established and started implementing 4 years ago. Efforts were most likely really going to start paying off in big way come the fall of 2025. Some of those steps included selective controlled burns to remove old bunch grass, which when burned had been disked to encourage forb growth. In other areas, selected trees where there was a dense canopy had been removed so all sunlight could reach the ground to encourage forb and woody browse growth. The ranch had also changed their supplemental feeding program to incorporate double down feed into a year-round feeding program. The latter was suggested because sometimes we forget we do not feed deer. We feed the microflora in a deer's digestive system, which breaks down what the deer eat. Every time their diet changes, the exiting microbes die and have to start all over once again. Double down feed also takes into consideration the deer's energy needs. Energy is particularly important to a deer's general health, including antler development and does producing healthy fawns. We had also properly harvested both bucks and does. having for the past 3 years primarily removed management bucks, those older aged bucks with less than desirable antlers. Not concerned about them passing on their genes, but they eat as much, if not more, than a younger buck with much better antler potential. We also carried on a proper doe harvest based on buck-to-doe ratio and deer density. I mentioned both fawn crop and recruitment. The fawn crop is essentially the number of fawns born, and usually expressed in terms of a percentage by dividing the number of does into the fawns seen. These figures are based on incidental observations, which is something as a biologist I highly encourage. Starting as soon as bucks show sufficient antler growth where they can be easily distinguished, start keeping a running record of the number of bucks, does, and fawns observed each time you go to the field, meaning your property or hunting lease. Makes no difference if you see the same deer again and again. Keeping record of what you see throughout the late spring, summer, and even fall provides good data as to determining your buck to doe ratio, fawn crop, and later in the fall, fawn recruitment. Recruitment is best described as those fawns that live to become at least 1.5-year-old deer, taking into account not all fawns born survive into the fall season when does start weaning their offspring. The better the day-to-day nutrition and fewer numbers of predators, primarily coyotes and bobcats, the greater the herd recruitment. By June, bucks are starting to once again become interesting. Antler development is well on its way, and you can at least start imagining what their racks will look like in 2 more months. It is truly amazing how rapidly antlers grow. You've heard me state this before, but it bears repeating. Texas bucks mature at 4 years of age. By then, all their long bones are fully developed, as are essentially their muscle systems. Up to the age of 4, body development always takes precedence over antler development. After 4 years of age, any daily nutrition not required for simple body maintenance can be channeled into antler development. This is why 4-year and older deer generally have bigger antlers. There is, however, a kicker in the deal. Much of the breeding is done by 2 to 4-year-old bucks. If they get severely run down because of the rut, their antlers may not be as big as one would imagine the following fall. I've seen some truly impressive 3-year-old 10-point bucks get severely run down from the rut and revert to producing very mediocre 8-point racks as 4-year-olds. Given a chance to reach 5 years old, that same buck will develop exceedingly impressive antlers. This is one of the reasons I caution hunters about shooting management 8-points. That 4-year-old 8-point you shot, left to recover, might at 5 years of age have been that absolute monstrously antlered buck of your dreams. May and June? Continue doing predator control and learn what you can about the property you hunt or plan to hunt this fall. Spend time shooting your rifle, handgun, muzzleloader, bow, and/or crossbow. Learn your guns, bows, or crossbows' capabilities and yours with them. Doing so will pay off come this fall. Email Larry Wysoon at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Keeping it fresh. Matt Williams, Texas Fish and Game's Freshwater Fishing Authority, TF&G Profile Series. Matt Williams is a distinguished outdoor writer whose extensive contributions to Texas Fish and Game magazine have solidified his reputation as a leading authority on freshwater fishing through his Texas Freshwater column. Matt has been closely associated with Texas Fish and Game almost from the beginning. He has served as freshwater fishing editor for a major portion of the magazine's history, his columns and feature stories appearing in most of its more than 400 issues. He has also proven himself as an expert on hunting in the Lone Star State through his many features in the magazine and beyond. His engaging storytelling and in-depth knowledge have made him a trusted voice for outdoors sports. His articles offer readers valuable insights into effective hunting strategies, innovative fishing techniques, and pressing conservation issues. Williams' ability to intertwine practical advice with compelling real-life stories has garnered him a dedicated readership. Williams' contributions to the outdoor community are not confined to Texas Fish and Game magazine. He has penned numerous articles for publications like the Lufkin Daily News and Beaumont Enterprise, where he reports on local fishing tournaments and profiles successful anglers. For instance, he highlighted the achievements of Texas anglers in recent fishing tournaments, providing detailed accounts of their strategies and successes. And no one does that quite like Matt Williams. He has a way of capturing the details of what pro anglers and guides are doing and make it work specifically for the Texas market. It's one reason his column has been important to Texas Fish and Game for so long. The fact he can make a 90-degree turn from his regular fishing beat and give you a super informative article about a legal issue involving hunting shows how good he is. Through his prolific writing and active participation in the outdoor community, Matt Williams continues to be a positive influence on the outdoors industry in Texas. His work not only educates readers, but also fosters a deeper appreciation for the state's rich hunting and fishing heritage. Thanks for listening. Remembering Brian Kirchhoff, Epic Classic Pro, Texas Freshwater, by Matt Williams, Texas Fish and Game, Freshwater Fishing Editor. We're at full stride of another season in big league bass fishing, and on the heels of another Bassmaster Classic, this one held back in March at Lake Ray Roberts near Denton. Thoughts of the late Brian Kirchhoff always come to mind when someone mentions the sport's most revered event. Kirchhoff won the 24th annual Classic, held on 15,500-acre High Rock Lake in Greensboro, NC, way back in 1994. Sadly, his promising career was cut tragically short about 4.5 months later. Kirchhoff was killed when American Eagle Flight 3379 crashed about 4 miles from the Raleigh-Durham International Airport in North Carolina while traveling between sponsor engagements. He was only 23. The lessons the young angler from Newtown, Connecticut, taught with his legendary victory continue to resonate with anglers around the globe, especially those hopeful club-level warriors with tall aspirations of making it big someday. The Classic win earned Kirchhoff a spot in professional bass fishing history and made him an instant inspiration to amateur anglers everywhere. It also made a strong case for his innate ability to think on his feet. A fast food cook who worked nights at the Ground Round restaurant at the time, Kirchhoff was the youngest competitor in the Classic mix that year. Bass founder and MC, Ray Scott, sometimes dubbed him the Hamburger Flipper. Kirchhoff qualified for the big show through the Bass Federation, now called Bass Nation, a grassroots organization built around bass clubbers from all around the country. Roughly 4 years after joining the Housatonic Valley Bassmasters Bass Club, he became the only amateur to win the sport's most coveted championship trophy in Bass's 50-plus year history. Followers of the sport may recall how Kirchhoff got onto the winning pattern that resulted in his dramatic Classic win 31 years ago. For those who don't, here's the skinny. Kirchhoff spent much of his pre-practice fishing structure away from the bank. He didn't have much luck until he found a couple of torn red shad plastic worms floating in the water. Assuming someone had caught fish on the worms, Kirchhoff dug into his own stash, found something similar, and started catching fish around docks. Come tournament time, he applied what he'd learned weeks earlier and put a whipping on a star-studded tournament field of 40 anglers. Kirchhoff, who refined the pattern by downsizing to light line and a small bullet weight, was the only angler in the event to turn in 3 consecutive limits. Adding to the Classic, lore was the base-shaped whistle Kirchhoff carried in his pocket throughout the tournament at the behest of a close friend, Roy Rickus. He tooted on the green whistle to commemorate each fish he caught. Several lessons can be learned from the outcome. The most obvious is pro bass fishing has no boundaries and that anyone can beat the odds and rise to the top when all the stars line up. Another is that anglers should always keep an open mind and be willing to try something different when other stuff just isn't cutting it. Little things can sometimes mean a lot when fishing for bass. This holds especially true when fishing on small water in a high-pressure situation at a time of the year when there are an abundance of fish holding around shallow cover. Changing up from what everyone else is doing can at times be the ticket to getting more bites and putting more fish in the boat. That's what Kirchhoff did. His decision to dare to be different earned him a $50,000 payday and a Bassmaster Classic win that is arguably among the most legendary outcomes the sport has ever seen. Email Matt Williams at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. Back to basics for reds, targeting grass flats for redfish. Feature article by Texas Fish and Game staff. There are few inland saltwater fishing experiences more exciting than pursuing redfish across the vast, shallow seagrass flats on the Texas coast. These shallow water battlegrounds, from the lower Laguna Madre to Christmas Bay, are where anglers test their patience, skill, and perseverance against one of the most formidable inshore game fish. For those willing to embrace the challenges like blazing sun, shifting tides, and the ever-present Gulf breeze, success in the seagrass flats awaits anglers. Seagrass flats are the lifeblood of the Texas coastal fishery, offering shelter and sustenance for redfish, speckled trout, flounder, and countless other marine species. These underwater prairies, composed of species like shoalgrass and turtlegrass, create a unique and essential ecosystem. Shrimp, crabs, mullet, and baitfish congregate in the seagrass, drawing in the ever-hungry redfish that prowl these shallows. The challenge of targeting reds in the flats lies in their wariness. Unlike deeper waters where they have a greater margin for escape, flats fishing requires an angler to be stealthy, observant, and well-versed in how these fish behave under different conditions. One of the most thrilling sights in inshore fishing is the sight of a redfish tail waving above the surface as it roots through the grass for crabs and shrimp. Tailing redfish are a fly angler's dream, but they also offer conventional tackle enthusiasts an opportunity to put their casting accuracy to the test. The key to capitalizing on tailing reds is approach. If you're wading, keep your steps slow and deliberate to avoid sending pressure waves through the water. If you're in a kayak, use the wind to drift silently into position. Make sure to present your bait or lure gently. Casting too aggressively can send your target fleeing before you even have a chance. For many Texas anglers, wade fishing is the method of choice when hunting redfish in the shallows. It allows for direct engagement with the environment, offering anglers an up-close perspective of the fish's movements. To make the most of wade fishing, opt for lightweight gear and polarized sunglasses to cut through the glare and spot fish more easily. Small topwater lures, soft plastics rigged weedless, and live shrimp under a popping cork are all effective choices. The trick is to read the water. Look for nervous baitfish, subtle wakes, and the telltale flick of a redfish tail. Kayaks provide mobility for anglers looking to access areas too shallow for boats. A well-positioned kayak can glide over the flats with minimal disturbance, allowing anglers to sight cast to reds before they spook. When kayak fishing, pay close attention to wind direction and tidal flow. These factors can dictate where redfish are staging and feeding. Use a push pole or a stakeout anchor to hold position once you've found a school and keep your casts precise. Too many careless casts can scatter a school in seconds. For anglers looking to take their skills to the next level, fly fishing for redfish in the seagrass flats is a pinnacle experience. A well-placed shrimp or crab imitation fly can be deadly when presented properly, but accuracy and patience are key. Redfish in the flats can be finicky. They often won't chase a fly like they might in deeper water. The best approach is to lead the fish by a few feet, letting the fly settle naturally before giving it the slightest twitch. If done correctly, this method can result in one of the most explosive strikes in inshore fishing. While redfish inhabit the flats year-round, certain seasons offer better opportunities for sight fishing. Spring and summer. Warmer water temperatures make redfish more active, often causing them to push into ultra-shallow waters. This is prime time for topwater action, with reds hitting walk-the-dog-style baits aggressively. Fall. Cooling temperatures bring massive schools of redfish together, particularly in October and November. This is a great time for kayak anglers to find large groups of reds blitzing bait on the flats. Winter. Cold fronts can push redfish into deeper pockets adjacent to the flats, but sunny afternoons often bring them back into the shallows. Slow-moving soft plastics and shrimp imitations excel in these conditions. Matching the hatch is crucial when targeting redfish in the seagrass. Here are some of the most effective baits and lures. Live bait. Live shrimp, finger mullet, and mud minnows under a popping cork are irresistible to reds. Soft plastics, paddle tails, shrimp imitations, and jerkbaits rigged weedless work wonders. Texas Fish and Game, boating editor Lenny Rudow is an ace redfish angler and offers the following tips for using plastics for reds. Use the lightest jig head, which still has enough weight for you to detect the bottom. Light heads give the jig a seductive sink that the reds just can't resist. The above notwithstanding, make darn sure you can detect bottom at all times, except when you're fishing weeds. Quite often, redfish will be feeding right at bottom and bouncing your jig along, allowing it to tap down for a fraction of a second is what will generate strikes. Try paddle tails. Yes, you'll catch redfish on curly tails and straight tails, but the paddles seem to evoke more strikes much of the time. Some claim it's the vibrations created by the tail wobbling back and forth. We don't have any evidence to back the assertion up, but maybe that's one of the reasons why they work so well. Topwater lures. Early mornings and late evenings are prime times for walk-the-dog-style topwaters. Flies, shrimp patterns, crab imitations, and small baitfish flies in natural colors excel in clear water. Fishing for redfish in the Texas seagrass flats isn't just about catching fish. It's about the entire experience. Whether wading, kayaking, or casting a fly, the pursuit of redfish in these shallow Texas waters is a truly incredible experience that blesses thousands of anglers every year. Thanks for listening.
Chasing Gag Grouper. Going Coastal by Kelly Gross, Texas Fish and Game contributing editor. When speaking of gag grouper, most people's minds are painted with images of offshore boats and deep dropping near oil rigs. But along the Texas coast, gag grouper can be found inshore amongst the jetty rocks, pilings, and other sunken structures. Known for their aggressive strike and fight, gag grouper are a challenging catch, but are one of the best eating with its crab-like texture. Gag grouper are without a doubt an interesting species. Their scientific name, Microlepis, derives from the Greek words micro for small and lepis meaning scale, referring to their small scales. Once gags mature, there's nothing small about them. They can reach up to 60 pounds and 48 inches in length, with the typical fish being caught in the 10 to 20 pound range. Their growth rate is very slow, with a slot or keeper-sized gag grouper taking 5 or 6 years to reach the minimum length of 24 inches here in Texas. Another unique thing about gag groupers is that they are all protogynous hermaphrodites, meaning they start their lives as females, but after a few years of spawning, some of them change into males. This switch usually happens once they are several years matured and much larger. The size groupers being caught near shore in Texas are most likely females. Lurking amongst the structure, gag grouper camouflage themselves into their surrounds and wait motionless for their next opportunity at a meal. Besides their stunning appearance, their violent strike once they commit to eating prey is what got me hooked. The vicious thump when they eat is intense, and make sure your drag is set tight because they will 100% try to swim back down to the structure they were on and break your line. Both live and artificial baits work when targeting gags. Artificial lures that we use for snook fishing work great, like a 3-inch DOA shad tail on a 3/8 ounce jig head. A lively finger mullet on a 6-0 or 10-0 hook will definitely do the trick. One thing I've noticed on good gag grouper fishing days is clear water. In one of the most memorable fishing trips I have ever had, both mangrove snapper and grouper were coming up to the top and ferociously eating our topwaters and free-lined mullet on the surface. Yes, you heard me right. Gag grouper on the surface. Whichever tactic you choose, make sure to beef up on your leader line. You'll be fishing pilings, jagged rocks, or oyster beds with a hole they are bedded down in. Once you hook up, 9 times out of 10, you'll notice your fishing line moving back towards where you hooked them. Using the proper fishing gear is key to keeping them away from potential hazards and out in open water for you or your best netman to land. Down here on the lower Laguna Madre, we have several zones where we can fish for gag grouper. The SPI and Boca Chica jetties hold all types of aquatic wildlife, as well as the deep water structures of the ship channel. The RGV Reef is only 13 miles northeast of the South Padre Island jetties and is a popular nearshore option for anglers to catch state water snapper, grouper, and more. At 1,650 acres, the RGV Reef is Texas' largest reef and one of the largest artificial reefs in the world. Professional crews continue to add to the reef by deploying concrete railroad ties and most recently a retired tugboat. The organization Friends of RGV Reef helps restore and enhance underwater environments, creates new homes for fish populations, and supports biodiversity in the Gulf. As Texas anglers, we are blessed to have a fishery that offers fishermen plenty of species to chase after. Enjoy your pursuit of checking this intriguing, unique, and beautiful species off your fishing bucket list this summer. And please remember, friends, to keep only what you need, not everything you catch. Email Kelly Gross at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening.
Groupon, Going After Goliath Grouper. Feature article by Paul Fusinski. I recently embarked on an adventure that was nothing short of epic. My journey took me off the Atlantic coast of Florida, where I joined Texas Fish and Game Hotspots. Focus writer and spot stalker guide service owner Captain Derek York, along with Michael Scherer of Fishing's Future and Chris Geib. Our mission was clear, to catch the elusive Goliath grouper, a fish that had long been on Derek's bucket list and had quickly captured my imagination. Coming from the Midwest, the ocean was as mysterious to me as the moon. Yet, the call of the sea was irresistible. I flew down to Orlando, met up with Derek, Michael, and Chris, and we set sail at the crack of dawn, our spirits high with anticipation. The open ocean awaited us, and with it, the promise of an encounter with one of its most formidable inhabitants. Our warm-up session involved tangling with amberjack and red snapper. These fish, though impressive, were merely the opening act to the main event. I couldn't help but marvel at the difference between these ocean giants and the freshwater fish I was accustomed to. The amberjack, in particular, tested our mettle, proving to be a formidable adversary that made even the hardiest fish I'd previously caught seem tame by comparison. The pursuit of the Goliath grouper was fraught with challenges. With just one bait fish to our name, every attempt had to count. Derek shared his lifelong fascination with these behemoths, and I could see the fire in his eyes as he spoke of his dream to catch one. Our strategy was bold and required us to race away from shipwrecks at high speed to prevent the grouper from entangling itself and breaking free. This adventure was more than just a fishing trip. It was a profound learning experience. We delved into the issue of barotrauma, a condition that affects Goliath groupers due to rapid changes in water pressure, causing their stomachs to protrude unnaturally. This highlighted the importance of conservation and the need for responsible fishing practices to ensure the survival of these magnificent creatures upon release. After achieving Derek's dream of catching a Goliath grouper, our day took an unexpected turn as a storm rolled in, forcing us to head back to shore. The adventure concluded with one of the most memorable catch and cooks I've ever had the pleasure of participating in. Reflecting on this experience, I realized how different ocean fishing is from what I'm used to back home. The fish in the ocean fight harder and longer, demanding respect and admiration. This adventure has left me with a deep desire to return to the sea, to once again challenge its inhabitants, and to continue advocating for their conservation. For now, though, I'll return to the familiar waters of my Midwest home, forever changed by my encounter with the giants of the sea. Thanks for listening.
Give the Outdoors. Alternative ideas for Mother's and Father's Day giving. Story by Fish and Game staff. When it comes to celebrating Mother's Day and Father's Day, Texas Fish and Game readers know that the best gifts aren't wrapped in bows. Instead, they are found in the great outdoors. And while everyone knows about bass fishing, white-tailed deer hunting, and the classic Gulf Coast saltwater adventure, there are plenty of outdoor experiences in Texas that many have yet to discover. This year, surprise your mom or dad with a gift that revolves around the hidden natural wonders of Texas. Here are some truly unique species that many outdoor enthusiasts don't even realize exist in the Lone Star State. Snook. Snook are typically associated with Florida's warm waters, but did you know Texas has its own population of these prized game fish? Found primarily in the lower Laguna Madre and around South Padre Island, snook offer some of the most exciting light tackle fishing in the state. Their acrobatic jumps, line-burning runs, and aggressive strikes make them a thrill to catch. Free-ranging nilgai. When people think of Texas big game, deer and hogs come to mind, but South Texas is home to an exotic giant, the nilgai antelope. Originally from India, these massive, blue-hued antelope roam free on some of the vast ranches of the coastal plains. Their sharp eyesight and speed make them a challenge to hunt, and their lean, flavorful meat is a trophy in itself. Free-ranging axis. Axis deer were introduced to Texas in the 1930s, and thanks to their ability to thrive in the wild, they now have free-ranging populations in the hill country and parts of South Texas. Known for their striking spotted coats and exceptional venison, often ranked better than beef in flavor and tenderness, axis deer offer an exciting alternative to traditional whitetail hunting. Guadalupe bass. Bass fishing is a Texas pastime, but did you know the Lone Star State has its very own native species of bass? The Guadalupe bass, Texas state fish, is found only in clear, fast-flowing hill country rivers. Smaller than a largemouth, but full of fight, catching one is a true badge of honor for any angler. Great white shark. While Texas is famous for redfish, speckled trout, and king mackerel, most people don't expect to see great white sharks off the coast. However, in 2024, reports surfaced of great whites showing up in Texas waters, drawn by warming currents and an abundance of food. Seeing one is rare, and they are protected from harvest, but the idea of sharing the water with these apex predators adds a whole new thrill to offshore fishing. Eastern wild turkey. Everyone in Texas knows about Rio Grande turkeys, but did you know the eastern wild turkey is making a comeback in East Texas? Once nearly wiped out, conservation efforts have successfully restored these birds to the Piney Woods region. They're larger and warier than their Rio cousins, making for an exciting and challenging hunt. Chachalaca. Chachalacas may sound like something out of a rainforest documentary, but these loud, chicken-sized game birds live in the Rio Grande Valley. Often heard before they're seen, chachalacas make for an interesting and underappreciated upland hunting experience. Pheasants. Many people associate pheasant hunting with the Midwest, but Texas actually has wild pheasant populations in the Panhandle and parts of North Texas. These colorful, fast-flying birds provide excellent upland hunting opportunities that rival those of the Dakotas. Elk. Believe it or not, elk still roam free in Texas. Most people assume these majestic animals are found only in Colorado or New Mexico, but free-ranging herds can be found in the Trans-Picos region. The mountains of West Texas provide rugged terrain and an unforgettable backdrop for an elk hunt. This year, instead of the usual coffee mug or gift card, consider giving your parents the gift of adventure. Whether it's hunting free-ranging exotics, fishing for an elusive Texas species, or embarking on a rare wildlife encounter, there's no better way to celebrate Mother's Day and Father's Day than by experiencing the unique biodiversity of Texas's great outdoors. Thanks for listening.
The Fish and Game Report, news of the outdoor nation, reported by Texas Fish and Game staff. Wardens bust illegal Texas deer operations. A recent investigation by Texas game wardens resulted in approximately 1,200 pending charges and 22 suspects from across the state involved in the deer breeding industry and black market wildlife trade. The suspects and charges are associated with 3 deer breeding facilities, 10 release sites, 1 deer management pen, and 3 illegal facilities not registered in the Texas Wildlife Information Management Service's TWIMS database, meaning they were operating or receiving deer in violation of registration requirements and disease monitoring protocols. The hard work and commitment of our Texas game wardens to uncover these violations cannot be overstated, said Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, TPWD, Executive Director David Yoskowitz. TPWD has referred the cases to prosecutors' offices in 11 Texas counties. The cases stem from a prior investigation involving the illegal smuggling of captive white-tailed deer, ultimately leading wardens to uncover this much larger network of alleged offenders after the arrest and conviction of two individuals that occurred in Montgomery County. The investigation uncovered approximately 500 Class C charges, 700 Class B charges, 22 Class A charges, and multiple state jail felony charges. Due to the ongoing nature of this case, the final number of charges filed may vary. I am incredibly proud of the dedication and diligence Texas game wardens devoted to this case, said caller Ronald Vanderroost, TPWD Law Enforcement Director. TPWD has established science-based regulations and procedures to both manage deer breeding in Texas and prevent major disease outbreak, all with the goal of ensuring the long-term sustainability of native and captive deer in Texas. Chronic wasting disease, CWD, is a fatal neurological disease and can devastate deer populations by silently spreading through direct animal contact and contaminated environments. Without close monitoring, illegal movement of captive deer increases the risk of introducing CWD to areas it is not known to exist, potentially leading to widespread outbreaks, which will impact more than just the health of Texas deer. Yoskowitz also noted that with many rural Texans depending on hunting as their full or supplemental income, a large-scale outbreak of CWD could pose a significant threat to white-tailed deer hunting, which has a $9.6 billion annual economic contribution and could irreversibly alter Texas's rich outdoor heritage. By circumventing requirements, disregarding regulations, and falsifying official records, the suspects in this case intentionally placed the state's entire deer population at risk, explained Vanderroost. These individuals and ranches operated with impunity, repeatedly violating established laws designed to protect Texas natural resources and safeguard the state's wildlife against disease transmission, Vanderroost said. TPWD remains committed to enforcing these laws and will hold violators accountable. Texas game wardens will continue to pursue those who disregard regulations and illegally exploit Texas's natural resources, putting both captive and native populations at risk. In other news, Lake Tawakoni delivers first-ever sharelunker. Angler Clayton Braddock of Argyle reeled in Lake Tawakoni's grand entry into the Toyota sharelunker program in March, catching the water body's first legacy-class fish. The lake became the 79th Texas public fishery to produce one of these massive largemouth bass, and Braddock's 13.30-pound sharelunker number 676 bumped the overall total to 7 during the 2025 Toyota sharelunker collection season. Braddock competes in Team Trail Outdoors fishing tournaments and has one scheduled at Lake Tawakoni in a couple of weeks. He headed out Sunday morning to practice, and due to some rain, didn't get on the water until roughly 8:30 a.m. They fished a couple of spots and came up empty, so they decided to go fish on some rocky areas. I was throwing a medium diver crankbait, and she bit in about 6 feet of water, said Braddock. All she did was head shake, and it almost felt like I had a 5-pound channel catfish on the line. I finally got her up closer to the surface and saw her side and knew she was different. I told my friend who I was fishing with to grab the net because I knew it was a giant. We got her in the net, celebrated, put her in the live well, gave her some time, and decided to weigh her. When we saw the weight, we knew at that point our plans had changed. The catch was a personal best for Braddock and broke his previous personal best of 9.25 pounds, which he set last year. Thanks for listening. Options aplenty. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Upper Coast Focus, Sabine Area. Reported by Captain Eddie Hernandez. We are right smack in the middle of the late spring and early summer months on Texas's upper coast. Just like that, we are now blessed with vast amounts of pretty warm water and an endless array of fishing patterns, techniques, destinations, and opportunities. Just about every inshore species are beginning to bite as the water consistently continues to warm. Deciding where to go is often the hardest part, since the bite should be on from the I-10 bridge to the Gulf of Mexico. If that decision brings you to the lake itself, finding trout, reds, and flounder shouldn't be that difficult. Several different paths will lead you to the fish. Here on Sabine Lake, the number of bayous you'll encounter on the eastern side between East Pass and Blue Buck Point should keep things interesting. bouncing soft plastics off the bottom or dragging curly tail grubs, live mud minnows or finger mullet in 1 to 6 feet of water should work well. Fishing the mouths of these bayous can be killer on trout, reds, and flounder as the warming water and bait fish move in and out with the tides. Another option is to run the open bay in search of schooling trout and reds. Whether gulls and terns are giving them away, or you just find shrimp skipping along the surface and fish blowing up the calm water, this is an action-packed way to spend the day. Topwaters, spoons, rattle traps, plastics, and just about anything else you can reach the fish with will get hit. The action is fast and furious while it lasts. Fish the area a little longer after they go down, then continue to run the lake slowly, watching the surface carefully for any sign of activity. A good pair of binoculars will definitely come in handy here. Oyster reefs and clam beds can also be major players, especially as the water temperatures begin to rise. The month of May is prime time to concentrate your efforts on areas such as mid-lake clamshell pads and the giant oyster superstructure that blankets just about the entire south end of Sabine Lake. Sand eels and other bait fish are attracted to these reefs and use them for nutrition and protection. Naturally, the abundance of bait that these reefs hold will attract and hold the big, mean predators as well. Before the water temperature really heats up, we like to bounce big, long, soft plastics over the shell. The longer baits emulate the size and shape of the sand eels, which are typically some of the first to show up on the big reefs. Contact Captain Hernandez at ghgs.eddie@gmail.com or go online to goldenhookguide.com. Thanks for listening. Summer's almost here. Fish and Game Forecast, Saltwater, Upper Coast Focus, Galveston Area, by Captain Derek York. Warm weather, lots of people out on the water, and great fishing means it's almost summertime here on Galveston Bay. I am ready for summer to get here, and May and June are always busy months for me getting people out fishing, especially with schools getting out for the summer and longer, warmer days ahead. Fishing can be fantastic at this time of year, both inshore and offshore. Right now, in the bay, we are catching lots of speckled trout and reds over shell and around marsh drains. I have been fishing mostly in the lower half of the bay lately, from lower East Bay to around the middle of West Bay. The Galveston Causeway can also be a great place to catch fish this time of year. Popping corks with shrimp and soft plastics on a jig head are usually the way to go. It is also a great idea to start the morning throwing some topwaters and experience the excitement of seeing those aggressive strikes on the surface. Jetties are also a good option right now and provide plenty of opportunity to catch sheep's head, black drum, red drum, and speckled trout. You can catch some nice speckled trout this time of the year out at the jetties on free-line shrimp. I always have multiple setups to fish out at the rocks, including a popping cork and shrimp, bottom knocker rigs, and one or two free-line setups for throwing shrimp up close to the rocks. And it still never hurts to keep one or two big rods out the back of the boat for something big. Bull reds, big black drum, and sharks are always looking for a good meal this time of year. And when the weather is right, I am running out in state waters looking for cobia around any of the close-in rigs and anything I find floating on the surface. We usually have some sargassum showing up this time of year. These fish are fun to see and catch and can provide a great fight. I keep a couple of big spinning reel setups rigged with a 60 to 80 pound fluorocarbon leader and circle hook to pitch a live bait to these fish. They will gladly eat a big shrimp or croaker most days. And if you are lucky enough to get one hooked up and to the boat, be ready when bringing them on board. I try to get them straight into the cooler if possible. Just think about how wild those bulls are in the pens at the Houston Rodeo are when trying to get the rider off. A green cobia on the deck can cause some serious damage to you and your boat if not prepared. Whether you are bank fishing, wade fishing, on a boat, or out with one of the many great guides on Galveston Bay, I know you are going to have a great time on the water. Just remember to stay safe and take a kid fishing. Email Captain York at spotstalkerfishing@sbcglobal.com. Thanks for listening. Take a kid fishing. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Upper Coast Focus, Matagorda Bay Complex. Reported by Captain Mark Talasek. It's a common sight nowadays to see a family sitting at a restaurant with everyone glued to their phones instead of enjoying each other's company. I'm guilty myself sometimes. Kids nowadays are entrenched in the technology world. Gaming and smartphones are the only entertainment they know. Very few kids get to experience God's great outdoors. Technology has become a built-in babysitter. Remember when we got our first push-button rod and reel? I would tie a weight on the end and play cast all day long before the days of video gaming. That is what entertained me as a kid. Trying to cast into buckets set up in the yard, practicing until we are ready for the real thing. Get a pound of dead shrimp, put one on a circle hook with a weight, and cast it off the pier, dangling your feet in the water, waiting for a hardhead to bite. The moment something tugged on the other end of your line, it was on. It was fun, even though most of the time there was a trash fish on the other end. There's something about never knowing what you are going to catch. I was lucky enough to have a father who was a fishing guide. I jumped in the boat every opportunity to go fishing. Some kids don't have that. If you get a chance, pass that knowledge on to them youngsters. Something as simple as tying a knot. We take it for granted, but someone else might not know. We all have to learn from someone. I learned something from every fishing trip. Countless times on the water, some good, some bad. Each trip was an experience. Where to go at certain times, where not to go, what bait to use, hook size, line type, rod and reel, weather, moon, tide, etc. There are so many factors to catch fish. Someone has to teach us. Basic navigation of a boat is something we take for granted. Putting the plugs in, loading, unloading, safety equipment, docking, submerged objects, etc. I unloaded my boat for the morning trip and was waiting for my customers when someone came up and said that my boat was sitting low in the water. Sure enough, I forgot to put the plugs in. Back on the trailer to let all the water out. LOL. Even the pros get complacent. It's my job to teach people how to fish. Take the time to share your knowledge of fishing with others. Also, how to be courteous and respectful of the outdoors. Summertime is upon us once again. Shorelines are holding fish early for waders throwing artificials. Mid-bay reefs are holding trout with drifters throwing live shrimp. Flounder gigging is great at night. Contact Captain Talasek at marktalasek@sbcglobal.com or go online to talasekguideservice.com. Thanks for listening.
Chasing Giants, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Port O'Connor, reported by Captain Kim Golden. The sun had barely touched the horizon when the first blow-up came. At first, it was a subtle slurp with the occasional fleeing bait, almost teasing with scattered showings. But then, the topwater assaults became more numerous and ultimately concentrated. Before long, we were smack dab in the middle of a full-blown bull redfish topwater feed. It was on. This young angler's hands were already steady on the rod, his body instinctively leaning forward, eyes locked on the water's surface. The boat rocked slightly as the current ripped by with a fresh influx of gulf bait. An offer was presented and the line pulled tight. He'd fished long enough to know it was something big. His heart skipped, then quickened as the fish made powerful runs deep. The rod bent almost to the breaking point and the fight was on. The fast current carried us out of the feeding frenzy while the fight was tough with wild bursts of energy. His fingers tightened around the grip, his knuckles white. He could hear the drag screaming as the big fish made a hard run after run. A rush of adrenaline coursed through him, the kind that only a battle like this could bring. For a moment, the world felt distant. Just him, the rod, and the unseen fish. Time slowed and the quiet hum of nature seemed to fade. Only the struggle mattered now. Another powerful yank. The line cut through the water like a knife, and he braced himself. The fish was fast, but so was he. He could feel the muscles in his arms tightening, each tug a reminder of what was at stake. Then, with a sudden surge, the fish broke the surface, its copper scales catching the sun in a flash of brilliance. It was massive, bigger than anything he'd caught out here before. Its body twisted and thrashed, sending droplets flying in every direction. His breath caught in his throat. This was it. the kind of catch people talked about for years. With a last desperate effort, he managed the last few cranks, arms straining with the effort. The big redfish fought one final time, then came in for landing. The young angler's heart pounded, his hands trembling as the fish breached the water's surface once more, its broad body gleaming in the morning light. Then, with one smooth motion, the big catch was scooped up into the boat. The moment hung in the air, suspended in time. He could hardly believe it. The fish thrashed in the bottom of the boat, its enormous golden body, a testament to the battle they'd just shared. He exhaled sharply, the adrenaline slowly fading. His pulse was still racing, but the rush of victory settled over him like a warm wave. This was the catch of a lifetime, three times over that morning. Contact Captain Golden at kimgoldenfishing@gmail.com or go online to portoconnorfishingtrip.com. Thanks for listening.
Baffin Bay Memories, the Fish and Game Forecast Center, Middle Coast Focus, Upper Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Richard Thompson. What does Baffin Bay mean to you? What about those incredible memories made there? Why is it so important to us here at R&K? Before we answer, do you actually know the history of Baffin? Baffin Bay, located at 27267 New North, 97.5821 West on the Texas Gulf Coast, is known for its rich marine life and unique limestone formations. Baffin Bay is an inlet of the larger Laguna Madre, comprised of three branches, Alazan Bay, Cayo del Grullo, and Laguna Salada. Baffin is the only bay in Texas with unique rock formations formed by ancient serpulid rock worms. These reefs attract anglers seeking trophy-speckled trout and redfish. Today, it is becoming a very popular spot for fishing, birding, and enjoying South Texas's untouched and still wild ecosystems. Baffin Bay's popularity has surged, especially for winter and early spring trophy trout. My social media is flooded with impressive catches this winter and spring. Wade fishing is the preferred method here as it forces anglers to slow down and fish each area thoroughly, resulting in more hookups. I have spoken to all the guides down here, and we are all seeing and reaping the reward of catching these giant trout as the TPWD regulation is paying off in dividends. The bait fish are becoming thick, and May-June is kicking off for the predator-prey game we all love to be a part of during this time of year. Here comes the good part. How are we and everyone else catching these beautiful specimens? We recommend a few lures we have used and have been extremely successful at landing these monsters. We typically throw a topwater first thing in the morning if the conditions are favorable. Head'n One Knocker Spook, pink and chrome, is my ultimate favorite, hands down. Transitioning to Coastal Brew Bait, Dart Bait 6-inch are our preferred, and we use all the colors depending on the water clarity, and we combine that with a 1/8-ounce or 16-ounce salty head lead head if we are fishing more shallow. Another dart bait that has a lot different action is the Down South Big Smooth, which the trout can't resist either. Last but not least, Miralure in XL and the original multicolors as well. These months really kick off croaker season, so that is a great method too if you know what you are doing. Back to the beginning when I said Baffin Bay means so much to us. We just created an apparel line called Baffin Bay Clothing Company, made here in America, and carefully designed to keep anglers' physical health a priority, as the material keeps them cool in the unforgiving South Texas elements. Also, we would love to share our new Laguna Shores Lodge, where our mission is to provide unforgettable coastal experiences through exceptional service, personalized hospitality, and a deep connection to the natural beauty of Laguna Madre. Whether hosting anglers, adventurers, families, or business professionals, we strive to create a welcoming retreat where memories are made, traditions are celebrated, and guests feel truly at home. We can't wait to meet you. We will hook you up. Contact Captain Thompson at rnkcoastaloutfitters@gmail.com or go online to rnkcoastaloutfitters.com. Thanks for listening. Like hanging out with an old friend. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Middle Coast Focus. Rockport, reported by Captain Jared McCulloch. If you haven't been able to get out and wet a line until now, I don't know your pain, but help is on the way. It's late spring, early summer, and it feels just like hanging out with an old friend. All the spots you remember as being good are almost guaranteed to be good. We have to wake up early to make sure the bait stand has enough croaker and shad, but it's always worth it somehow. Keep an eye out for mixed shell on bottom or old structure for trout to push their stomachs on. Even hard sand can hold some healthy trout. Push up tight and find some reds nearby as well. Don't overlook keeping a fast-sinking cast net in the boat. If you run by a fresh group of shad, turn around and get some fresh shad. If you have more of a round live well, try to keep a couple alive to use. A live shad could reignite a dead bite. There are always windy days down here, and this stretch is no different. Don't be afraid to get in the middle of the flats and pothole some gorgeous trout. You'll be glad you didn't take the rough ride across and still have plenty of success. By June, as the trout bite heats up, it always feels like the redfish start to disappear. They technically are those white igloos who have a way with them. Push off the islands and work the next set of potholes out, or further out, finding deeper structure that people haven't been on can hold a nice bounty of reds seeking refuge from the props. For the wading crew, I rarely ever see it anymore, but the Fulton shoreline should be looked at from Google Maps. It feels too simple, but all the grass, old shell, old rocks, old piers, and hard sand, a fish would have to be against something there. I like tans with silver or gold specks. DSL lures, so even when there's a bunch of smaller trout you have to work through, you still have a lure on your hook. Good luck out there, and slow the boat down. No telling how many times just cruising barely on plane has something caught my eye. From shad being chased, to mullet flipping, to mud boils, dolphins pushing in groups, color changes in water, a little eddy. It could be your next honey hole. Contact Captain McCulloch at firstlighttexas@gmail.com or call 210-478-6519. Thanks for listening. Abundant daylight and croakers. The Fish and Game Forecast Center. Lower Coast Focus. Baffin Bay. Reported by Captain Jared Merritt. Longer days, warmer weather, and croaker season make this my favorite time of year. With the summertime season in full swing, we no longer have to battle and base fishing patterns off of unpredictable cold fronts that drastically shift temperatures and wind direction. Although we may have the occasional Gulf storm to contend with, we are able to gather more insight on the trout routines with more consistent weather conditions. In May, we are experimenting with several different techniques and locations to establish where the fish are more predominantly gathering and feeding. We are fishing grass lines, drop-offs, and hitting all the rock structures we can in the time we have. For the groups that do not mind a little bit of a run, we are occasionally heading into the Laguna Madre and land cut. This allows me to get a better idea of what areas are producing and which areas are not, while still allowing customers to have a nice experience and catch fish. There will be days in early May where we must move 10 or 12 times while we try and lock them down. This movement is because we are switching over from lures and live shrimp to croaker as the bait of choice. With that said, we still will throw lures at the customer's request. When we are lure fishing, I highly suggest making it a wade fishing trip. The colors and tails I suggest throwing depend greatly on the sunlight, water clarity, grass, and bottom, along with water depth. On wade fishing days, I like to utilize the southernmost shoreline of Baffin Bay as it has a nice bottom. However, there are a few times I will head into the Laguna Madre and fish around certain spoil islands that I have found impressive fish on over the years. For anglers that do not mind a challenge, I have had success on hot days wade fishing the quicksand like mud Baffin offers. These areas have proven to hold some thick-shouldered and heavier fish when the temperature gets high. However, this is a task that takes work, endurance, and strength, as the suction of the mud is not for the average person. Regardless of your fishing method, this is a great time of year to get out on the water in Baffin Bay. With the beautiful weather, it is a great time to get family and friends together and enjoy quality time while making memories you will never forget. Contact Captain Merritt at jaredmerritt@gmail.com or visit his website, paradiseguideservices.com. Thanks for listening. Jetty Giants, and Flats Runs. The Fish and Game Forecast Center, Lower Coast Focus, Lower Laguna Madre, reported by Captain Brian Barrera. May brings consistent warmer water temperatures and transitioning fish patterns. Some fish will still be working in their cold weather patterns, and some fish will be working in their hot weather patterns, so it can be hard to target them consistently during this month. For some reason, I tend to catch fish in a little bit murky and deeper water this time of year. Drifting or wade fishing the flats for slot redfish and trout in deeper grass flats and channel edges with a slightly heavier jig or a slow sinking suspending style bait seems to be my go-to. If I have clients that prefer to use bait this time of year and the fish have been in the murky water, I will use a loud popping cork with 15 to 20 inches of 30-pound fluorocarbon leader tied to a 4-0 circle, hook and fresh-cut ballyhoo or mullet for bait. I use a bit of a different method in the clear water this time of year, such as heavy topwaters that I can launch far ways away, or a heavy drop-shot-style rig with a circle hook and fresh-cut bait. Although artificials are always my preferred, May tends to be a month where I use cut bait the most. The extreme heat of June marks the beginning of a lot of bait, fish, migrations, and smaller bait. Fish start flooding into our flat system through the inlet from the ocean, and with the mullet and menhaden, you can rest assured that the giant bullheads and tarpon will soon follow. I like to cruise up and down both the channel and beat sides of the jetty using my Humminbird Solix to locate schools of bait as well as schools of bigger fish, generally located somewhere close by. If the schools of fish that seems to be sitting in one specific area, I will spot lock directly on top of them, give or take 20 yards, depending on the current, and drop baits or lures directly down into the schools. If the school is a fish that seems to be moving or cruising around, then I prefer to drift using anything from 1 to 7 ounce weights to keep baits on or near the bottom. During low light conditions and peak times of the tide, you can sometimes find these fish busting baits on the surface, in which case I love to use a big soft plastic, or if you have time to tie one on before the frenzy stops, a big top water popper. Redfish and trout on the flats will be fully into their summertime patterns by now and a lot easier to target consistently. Early mornings and late evenings tend to be the best bite this time of year. Contact Captain Barrera at CaptBrianBFishing@gmail.com or visit his website, InshoreFishingSouthPadre.com. Thanks for listening.
A Force of Nature, On the Hunt for Nilgai, The Fish and Game Hunting Center, story by Leanne Powell. In the wild, where courage meets skill, one woman stands out, Michelle Rathkamp. A force of nature whose prowess in hunting doesn't just earn respect, it commands it. As an avid angler who's spent time in the woods with a few, I can confidently say Michelle is a rare breed. Her expertise and unwavering confidence make her an unforgettable companion in the great outdoors. Each year, Michelle applies for Texas parks and wildlife management hunts, including the archery draws. One of the most challenging Texas draw hunts, with an 8% success rate overall, and a mere 1% success rate for Nilgai, caught her attention. When she got the email saying she'd drawn a spot for the December 16-20 hunt, she didn't waste a second securing her permit. Day 1. Unfamiliar with the refuge and the specific region for hunting, she eagerly anticipated the opportunity to pursue whitetail and Nilgai. Seeking guidance and information from others, she embarked on a scouting day to survey the land, searching for fresh tracks and signs of deer and Nilgai, including high game trails and other indicators. Satisfied with her chosen area, she pedaled in on her bike and set up a pop-up blind the following morning. While observing a doe crossing her path, she later spotted another doe and a buck that used the same trail, yet found it challenging to get a clear shot at their vitals. Day 2. On the second day, Michelle left her blind and positioned herself under some trees and brush along the trail. Concealed in the foliage, she heard a whitetail blowing. Initially unable to spot the source, she quickly realized it was a young buck expressing its disapproval of the pop-up blind she had left out. After the buck made a swift exit, she retrieved her blind and repositioned it under a nearby tree. This gave her two shooting lanes, one on the left and one on the right. Later that day, a doe unexpectedly appeared, not on the anticipated trail, but to her right, less than 20 yards away. It was evident that the doe, like the buck earlier, was unsettled by her pop-up blind. Michelle folded the blind and retrieved a camo cloth from her backpack, seeking a location that offered both cover and clear shooting lanes. She found a large mesquite tree with some grass on one side. There, she constructed a makeshift blind using dead limbs, the tree, and nearby brush to secure the cloth and protect it from the wind. This two-sided impromptu blind seemed perfect, granting her an excellent field of vision with 90-degree shooting lanes to her right and left. Day 3. On the third day, the morning was slow and she only spotted a pig, a coyote, and a couple of distant whitetails walking on a trail. Day 4. The fourth day began with rain, which boosted Michelle's prospects, as she suspected that many other hunters had chosen to sleep in due to the weather. Once the rain subsided, a boar passed by, but she chose not to take the shot. Later, she noticed movement to her left, behind some trees and brush, but was unable to discern what it was. Using her binoculars, she identified a cow nilgai with a calf, marking her first in-person sighting of a nilgai. The cow approached, stopping about 25 yards away, and stared at her. As she waited for the cow to be distracted, she prepared to draw her bow. However, as she began to draw, the sound of her jacket startled the cow, causing it to flee. While she regretted not being more cautious about the noise of her clothing, the cold and wet weather left little choice. The rest of the day was uneventful, but tough in the face of continued frigid conditions. Day 5. On the fifth and final day, she woke up early, mentally preparing herself to make the most of the day. She encountered a coyote running toward her, but it quickly turned and fled once it realized she was there. Despite this, she remained hopeful. Later, she noticed the presence of some nilgai calves and a cow. She prepared her bow and waited for an opportunity to draw on them, but they moved off in a different direction. As the animal activity slowed, she spent time deep in thought, engaging in internal dialogue and observing the surrounding environment. Suddenly, a cow nilgai appeared about 30 yards away. Her heart racing, Michelle eagerly waited for the cow to approach, but it walked out of her shooting range. She debated whether to stay put or attempt to stalk the cow, then decided to move toward cover. When she returned to her blind, the cow appeared again, standing behind a tree. She waited for the right moment to draw her bow and set her sights on the approaching cow. When the cow stopped roughly 20 yards away, she took the shot and her arrow struck the cow's chest. She heard the impact and saw the cow flee, mentally marking the last place she saw it. She waited a short while and then began to search for the cow. She found blood and tracked it using her OnX hunting app, eventually discovering the cow less than 20 yards away, having successfully completed her hunt. She marked the cow on her OnX map, then made her way back to her bike to gather her gear, knife, and game bag, planning to walk straight in from the trail to retrieve the meat. Using the OnX app, she relocated the cow and began to quarter her, managing to cut off both hindquarters and a shoulder. Realizing she couldn't carry all three quarters by herself, she packed the shoulder and a hindquarter in her bag and headed to her bike. Despite getting turned around a few times, she eventually made it to the main trail where her bike was waiting. She wrapped the quarters in the cloth from her blind, hoping to retrieve the rest of the meat before dark and before coyotes found it. While wrapping up the meat, she noticed two men approaching down the trail with e-bikes and a cart. Michelle was one of the only ones in the woods at the time of this hunt with a good old-fashioned pedal bike. With a sense of relief, she accepted the biker's unexpected help. Together, they retrieved the cow and got her back to Michelle's truck. Reflecting on the experience, she found the biking in and out during the mornings and evenings to be the most challenging part. The physical exertion took a toll, especially in the rain and mud, making her consider investing in an e-bike for future hunts with similar transport requirements. Despite the hardships, she was proud of the effort she put in. Arriving at her blind early every morning and staying until after sunset, She had even made meaningful connections with the wildlife and deepened her spirituality through conversations with nature and with God. And despite not having success until the final day, she was content with the experience and looked forward to applying for the same hunt in the future. Thanks for listening.
A look at Texas turkey. Aptitude Outdoors by Texas Fish and Game, contributing editor Paul Fusinski. Texas is known for its vast landscapes and diverse wildlife, but maintaining this natural heritage requires continuous conservation efforts. Kyle Hand, the statewide game bird specialist with Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, shared his expertise on wild turkey conservation in a recent interview, highlighting the challenges and strategies involved in preserving these iconic birds. Kyle's primary role is to support various program leaders within the small game program, such as those focusing on turkeys and waterfowl, to implement effective conservation practices. He emphasizes that habitat degradation and fragmentation are the most pressing issues affecting wildlife populations in Texas. Eastern turkeys, Meleagris galopavus sylvestris. Size and appearance. Eastern turkeys are generally the largest of the wild turkey subspecies. They have a more robust build compared to their Rio Grande counterparts. Eastern turkeys typically have darker, chestnut-colored feathers, especially on the tail fan and coverts. Behavior and adaptability. Eastern turkeys exhibit a high degree of adaptability. They are known for their ability to thrive in various environments, from dense forests to more open woodlands. This adaptability is partly due to their flexible roosting habits, as they do not rely heavily on specific roost sites and can move between different trees night after night. Habitat preferences. These turkeys are commonly found in the eastern parts of Texas, particularly in the Piney Woods region. They prefer areas with abundant cover and a mix of open spaces and dense vegetation, which provides both food and protection. Rio Grande turkeys, Meleagris galopavus intermedia. Size and appearance. Rio Grande turkeys are slightly smaller than eastern turkeys. They exhibit a range of feather coloration, appearing lighter with a more varied plumage. Their subspecies name, intermedia, reflects their intermediate characteristics, as they can exhibit traits seen in both eastern and Merriam's turkeys. Behavior and water dependency. Unlike eastern turkeys, Rio Grande turkeys have a strong dependency on water sources. They are often found roosting near water, such as rivers, streams, or ponds. This dependency on water dictates their habitat preferences and roosting sites. Habitat preferences. These turkeys are well suited to the more arid regions of Texas, including central Texas and the post-oak savanna. They prefer open country with scattered trees, which provide necessary roost sites. Their habitat selection is influenced by the availability of water and suitable roosting trees, making them more predictable in their roosting behavior compared to eastern turkeys. The aim of wild turkey restoration efforts in Texas is to establish huntable, sustainable populations, ensuring ecological balance, recreational opportunities, and economic benefits. This involves creating and preserving habitats that support the turkey's life cycles, from nesting and brood rearing to foraging and roosting. Texas's diverse habitats present unique challenges. According to Hand, the decline of grassland-dependent birds, including wild turkeys, is largely due to habitat loss. In East Texas, wild turkeys struggle with limited brood rearing and nesting habitats. Early successional habitats, like those formed 3 to 5 years post-burn, provide essential cover and food sources for these birds. In South Texas, the availability of large roosting trees is crucial, while in the rolling plains, a mix of woody and herbaceous growth supports turkey populations. Hand notes that maintaining these varied habitats is key to ensuring the survival of wild turkeys across the state. Monitoring and managing diseases in wild turkey populations is an ongoing effort. Predator management is another important aspect of conservation. While predators are a factor due to the overabundant amount of food available on ranches with feeders available across the state, Hand believes habitat degradation plays a more significant role in population declines. A combination of effective habitat management and targeted predator control can benefit wild turkey populations. Stocking strategies. Texas has shifted to a super stocking strategy to improve the success rate of reintroducing wild turkeys. Super stocking is a conservation technique used to boost turkey populations in areas where they have significantly declined or disappeared. This method involves releasing many wild turkeys, typically from regions with healthy populations, into the targeted areas to quickly establish a sustainable and breeding population. Private landowners play a crucial role in habitat conservation. HAND encourages landowners to contact their local biologists for assistance with habitat improvement projects. The department has also started using Pittman-Robertson funds to provide cost-share assistance to landowners, enhancing the department's ability to support conservation efforts on private lands. Habitat barriers, like those around Toledo Bend, limit turkey movement and connectivity between populations. Drought and habitat changes also impact reproduction rates. HAND believes ongoing research will help identify and address the underlying issues affecting wild turkey populations. Wild turkey conservation in Texas is a complex and ongoing effort. By addressing habitat degradation, managing predators appropriately, and supporting private landowners, the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department aims to preserve these iconic birds for future generations. Email Paul Fuzinski at contactus@fishgame.com. Thanks for listening. This concludes this audio edition of Texas Fish and Game Magazine, May, June 2025. We hope you have enjoyed this issue. Print and digital versions of this publication are available on our website, fishgame.com. This has been a production of Texas Fish and Game Publishing Company, LLC. Copyright 2025. All rights reserved.